Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, plant people. How are you guys doing today? If you're new around here, my name is Ashley and I'm a soul scientist. On this channel, I like to take plant science and apply it to all things plants. And in today's video is my solicited, unsolicited advice on Jess from Roots and Refuges soil situation. So this was brought to my attention by several of you guys via Instagram, YouTube, you name it, saying I needed to watch Jess's last two videos because she's having a soil issue and they thought I would be interested in watching it, all the way to I'm having something very similar to this, what the heck is going on? And her first video, she kind of just shows the issue and how it's represented in the plants. And then her second video, she goes into a bit of a rant about how she's upset with the direction the industry, in particular soil industry, is going. And it's, I mean, completely justified. Gardeners of that scale in particular put a ton of time but money into gardens. So for it to do what it did is incredibly frustrating. And I don't blame her at all for getting upset. But we're gonna go over kind of a little bit on ways she can, or you can, in if you're suffering from the same issues, reclaim it in less than the 5 years that she's concerned it will take her to potentially turn this around. And she's doing a really good thing by not simply just ripping all that soil out and then replacing it with something new. So when I initially watched the first rant video, she essentially said in there that the soil was damaged. It was contaminated by Grazon in particular, aminoprilate, which is a persistent herbicide. It's different than a Roundup glyphosate type thing, which is not a persistent pesticide, herbicide. And so she believes it's Cisgraxin, which it, I mean, very likely could be. We'll talk about what else it could be, but I'm thinking she's probably leaning in the correct direction. It's some form of broadleaf desiccant. The only reason I don't necessarily think it's Graxin in particular is because Graxin has, like, she's cucumbers and stuff that are fine, which makes me lean toward it potentially being like a chemical industry surfactant more so that's used for decomposing and helping with water penetration and compost. But anyways, so with her issue, she's not using just soil. And this was one of the initial things that I was a little bit confused by, because I watched the last video first and she was saying that this was imported soil, etc. and so forth. And so I initially thought to myself, well, where the heck did she get that soil from? Because soil naturally, even if it is contaminated, doesn't hold on to herbicides in that way. It's much different. And then I began to think, well, no, she's got the cardboard laid down. This is probably like a no-dig, full-blown compost setup, which many of you, if you've been on this channel, know I'm not a huge advocate for. It's okay if you do it. I mean, just plant the garden. I don't care how you do it. It's just not the method that I like. And we're actually running an experiment over on Mind and Soil's YouTube channel where we are going from a no-dig compost garden to a soil garden, just to see how it affects some things, because his soil tests, which are essentially soilless tests, if you're using straight compost, you're not working with soil at that point, we're showing very bizarre values in micronutrients, macronutrients, soil pH, organic matters, that sort of thing. So she is, for all intents and purposes, growing in a soilless medium. She's growing in straight compost, and she brought this in. She imported it in from somewhere in bags. And the company's been made aware of the issue. They've reached out and they're gonna help her reclaim it. I think that the company, from what I heard in the second video, is on the right path, but there are some other things that she tried to give a shot here. So first off, it could be this Graxin or Graxin, whatever, however you want to pronounce it. It could be the aminoprilate persistent herbicide in that compost that is the issue. And that wouldn't surprise me, because what happens is when aminoprilates or persistent herbicides are sprayed onto a plant material, and then that plant material is then composted, it amplifies over time. And I have an interview coming out, fingers crossed, next week, where I'm talking to a natural resource management professional from the peat industry. I interviewed him, and in it I asked the question, you know, what about the big movement of gardening in straight compost? And he said he always shies away from that, and industries involved in food production on a large scale also will shy away from using straight compost. And the reason for that is because there is a potential for amplification of any issues that may be there. And now these may not be as severe as what maybe Jess is seeing, but they can be on a smaller scale amplification of, say, a micronutrient for a plant that is a hyperaccumulator for something like zinc or copper or boron. And when we compost that in the wrong ratios, and we plant our plants in it, and we plant something that's maybe sensitive to excess boron, we can end up with poor yields that we don't even realize we're having. We'll blame it on the weather or poor watering or whatever the case is. Or we can have something really severe where we're seeing this cupping or the shrinking of leaves. And so that's why I always say at least a 50-50 mix if you can, and that's what I prefer, and that's what I advocate for people to do as well. Now, with that being said, there is potentially another cause for this, and it could be chemical surfactants used in the composting process. So when you look this up, it's becoming more and more common, actually, oddly enough, where chemicals are being used on compost to help with the decomposition process. And this is because the demand for compost is really, really high right now, between new gardeners and their setups, to the explosion of no dig and the simplification of just that gardening way of doing things. Surfactants are becoming more and more popular. There's lots of papers written on them, and while there's no real known documented side effects, it wouldn't shock me if there was. For example, Jess is having a lot of problems with the nightshade family, but not having any issues with her cucumbers or her squash or anything of like that. So it wouldn't shock me if there's a potential that there's some form of chemical surfactant that made its way into that compost that company's using that has a negative effect on nightshades, but doesn't have an effect on the cucumber plant, which would be even more likely in Jess's situation, because apparently testing has been sent back to the lab and they're not able to test for any of these herbicides that they're suspecting is causing the issue. Which, if you did not know, typically when we test any sort of plant biomass, which is essentially what compost is, we're able to get accumulations of high anything. We can tell what's in that. So that's one thing to keep in mind. And always, I've had this happen to me too, by the way, with compost, you need to pre-test. So since that day, about 5 years ago, when I had contaminated compost, I don't know what was in it. It was some sort of persistent herbicide. It took out the nightshade family. All I could grow on it was corn, and that I was able to reclaim in about 3 years. But since then, I've only ever done pre-test using peas or beans, something that grows quick and is a broadleaf. And I will compare a control in straight peat or coconut coir, whatever the case is, soil against the compost grown ones. And I want to make sure that my leaves, everything is the same size. Everyone looks the same. As long as it passed the pretest, which I've mentioned in other videos, then it gets put onto the garden. Until then, it stays off the garden, because like I said, I've been burned by this before, and it will take out an entire bed for minimum of 1 year, if not longer. So if you've been on this channel long enough, you know that basically any sort of pesticide or herbicide, and because I've worked in this industry as well, producing these things, or not producing, testing for the government of Canada to see if they will meet the qualifications to be purchased by humans. One of the things we've talked about is microbial degradation, in particular the soil's degradation over time. So microbes in the soil will eat away at the compounds of pesticides, and this is one of the factors that make it legal to apply them, because they will degrade. If they don't degrade, they don't pass the smell test by the government, basically. So because they're biodegradable, there are ways that we can help the biodegradation process. So So for example, we can add more compost that is not contaminated. We can add a wide manure of different composts, such as manures of all different forms, mushroom compost, vegetative compost, you name it. So that's one way to help increase the microbial activity. The second way would be through temperature. Now, Jess is automatically in a very warm climate, so she doesn't have to maybe necessarily do this, but for some of us in a colder climate, this could come in the form of solarization, not cooking of the soil, but just a warming up of the soil through solarization. It can also come in the form of mulching here. Once the soil gets a little bit warmer, we mulch to help insulate the heat, which will allow the degradation process to take place longer into the winter month. The next method is going to be increasing soil moisture. So keeping that soil moisture 80 and above at all times is going 80% or above field saturation is going to be the key to really helping the decomposition process. Microbes thrive on moisture. So if we allow things to dry out, every time that happens, we slow down the microbial process. We have to wait for those areas to maybe be recolonized depending on the type of microbe we're dealing with. So just to help with that process and making a very happy, healthy area for it, using mulch and keeping water in that area is going to be key. Now, the next method isn't gonna work for Jess necessarily right now, because from my understanding, is she's gonna continue to plant in that area. Although I don't think she's gonna get any yields off that plant. So I, Jess personally, would rip those plants out and I would till.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
But, and I know this sounds terrifying for some people, especially those of you that are doing a no-dig situation where you have the cardboard down and it looks all good. But the truth is that aeration and air being introduced into that area is going to amplify the microbial process. So if she aerated it just with a pitchfork on the surface level and didn't touch the soil, but just moved the compost in general, that's going to help with air infiltration, oxygen infiltration, which microbes really like, and it really gets them going. This is why when we till, we usually see really amplified growth that first year. When we first lay down compost in a no-dig system, we really see rapid growth, and it's because of that aeration taking place. But she can also do a method of aeration combined with dilution. So she could till that compost, remove the cardboard, and then till, or she could leave the cardboard in place, I mean, all intents and purposes, and then till that compost layer into the soil layer below. I'm not sure what kind of soil she has underneath that, but all in all, we're going to dilute pretty much in half, depending on the depth we can get that rototiller to, but we can, you know, reduce that by half, use a dilution method with a soil combined with the oxygenation plus the increased of different microbial capacities from different compost sources, and we're really going to see some rapid degradation of whatever the heck is in that soil. So I did this personally with the garden that I was having issues with, because I don't shy away from till. I don't really care, to be honest. And so what I did was I did my compost layer on top. So I actually tilled that in. Now that was in a raised bed at the time. So I did like a broad fork method of tilling, where I shoved the broad fork in and I really flipped it. Like I did a total soil turnover and I really diluted it down to about 12 to 16 inches in depth with the soil I had beneath. And I was able to reclaim that soil. Basically by the next year it was fine. So that would be another method that you could give a try out. And that one probably is going to be the most essential and the most effective. So the second method, equally as effective to argue, actually all these would work. If you use these all in combination, Jess, if you're watching, I would check out you are. I honestly think you could probably turn this whole train around within a year max. But you'd have stuff growing in there within 6 months to a year, because you have a continuous cropping situation where you are too, so you could really turn this around quick. The next one is going to be cover cropping, but with the cover cropping method, you want to go for something with really high biomass. You want to go for something that is a hyper accumulator or a phyto reclaiming version of whatever you choose. In your situation, because you're having issues with broad leaves, I would stick with a monocot variety. So whether this be ryegrass or corn, something of that nature, wheat, all these things will work. Sunflowers, while they sound like a good idea, may not grow as efficiently or as effectively in that soil. Not saying they won't, but they just may struggle a little bit. Because if it is a broadleaf desiccant issue, you don't want to put dicots in or broadleaves in. You want to stick with the monocot varieties. And then what you're going to do is literally let that thing grow, and you're going to water it, and you're going to treat it like it is the most expensive exotic tomato plant you've ever had in your life. You're going to baby it, and you want it to grow to excess. Once that is completed, you're going to want to cut down all the biomass. Not what you normally would do with a cover crop, where you would like fold it down and then solarize or kill it in that way. You're going to cut it, and then you're going to take all that biomass off your property and burn it, bury it, do whatever you have to, but you don't want to compost or do anything with it. You want to dispose of it. It is now considered reclamation, biohazardous waste. You just get rid of it. And you can do this in between cropping seasons, but to be honest, right now with your situation, I would clear cut everything and then just start from scratch. And I would start with a cover crop with a ton of upper biomass, just really cut it down. And I would talk to a local university and ask them for phyto reclaimers that are particularly predisposed to taking up whatever potential nutrient issue or chemical issue you're having. So there's lots of different crops out there, and there's lots of different studies that have been made, but they'll know combination of your soil type with your zone what variety of plant is best. So they will have probably a very specific variety of corn that would work for this application. Which brings me into my second point about cover cropping, is if you could get like a micronutrient profile from the company that did the testing. If they're testing for micronutrients, there is a slight possibility that it has nothing to do with pesticides. It has something to do with an amplification of something that's a hyperaccumulator being composted into that. Maybe something that has boron hyperaccumulation in it. For whatever reason, it just took up a bunch of boron or aluminum, whatever the case is, and was composted into that, which if that is the case, then you would just purchase and sow the plant that has a high affinity for boron, and then use that as the cover crop and then destroy it, obviously, in that case. But that's only if it's a micronutrient high bioavailability issue over another issue, which, I mean, your pH or your compost, technically, if it's, you know, alkaline or acidic, could really, you know, amplify the bioavailability of something. And it's just all things to think about. And the reason I say that is because her pesticide tests are coming back with nothing. There's no results on them, which is odd to me, which makes me think there's a potential that it's something else. So I think the next point that I'm going to make, she did mention that she's doing this, and that is going to be biochar or charcoal, preferably biochar. So the use of biochar, we've talked about before, it has a really high cation exchange capacity. It has the ability to hyperaccumulate different forms of toxins and micronutrients, you name it. So regardless of if it's a pesticide issue or if it's a potential micronutrient amplification issue or something in between, like a surfactant issue, it won't matter because the biochar is just going to neutralize everything. Now, in an ideal world, you'd have a way of removing the biochar. And I haven't really seen any studies or experiments when it comes to reclamation on removable biochar sources, whether that would be in the form of like a PVC pipe with like holes drilled through it filled with biochar that then would allow water soluble contaminants to then go into the biochar so it can be removed from the soil. Like, I mean, there's many different ways you could try to make a removable biochar contaminant, because ideally it just would be entirely removed from the soil. So what the biochar will do is it will sequester the toxin or the issue, but it won't remove it. So it's always going to be there. And then theoretically over time, when the biochar decomposes, it could be released. But I mean, I've also been to soil forestry sites where we've dug down and done soil profile digs, and there's biochar from a forest fire from 110 years ago. Just to put that into perspective, this stuff just doesn't simply decompose incredibly easily. So, I mean, it's up to you. And the last one is organics, organics, organics. Now, this is just kind of a combination of all of the above points, from increasing microbial densities, diversities, increasing water holding capacity, just dilution of the whole system, taking a poor compost and mixing it with a good compost naturally will dilute the system, so maybe the intensity of the product present won't be as high, and then just overall being able to plant in a zone above a potential other organic source, along with cation exchange capacity increases, you name it. I mean, the list goes on and on. So if you used all these things in combination, you'll be able to come back from contaminated soil or bad soil or poor soil. But keep in mind, you're not growing in soil at this point. You're growing in a soilless medium, essentially, is what's happening. So incorporating it into a soil that naturally is a buffer is really going to help with this. Just in general, this is why I plant in soil personally, is what I enjoy. I know how to manage it. There's no curveballs with soil. It just does its thing, in my opinion. But yeah, you can come back from it. It's possible. I've come back from it, but I've had the same thing happen to me as well. It's incredibly upsetting. So I totally understand. The fact that she didn't cry in that video was shocking, because when it happened to me, I bawled my eyes out, because it literally took out 24 tomatoes on, like, and that was like one of my primary beds. Anyways, long story short, it's an absolute pain in the butt. It's absolutely heartbreaking, but it's really quick and easy to turn around. Organic material, diversity in microbes, feed them microbes. Now, if you want to feed the microbes, I would do like compost teas, algae, fertilizers, molasses, honey, you name it. Mix it all in. It's all good. All these things are going to feed the microbes, and you'd be shocked at how quickly they can decompose some of this stuff. Aeration is going to be key. Getting a carbon source such as charcoal or biochar in there is going to help immensely, along with cover cropping. Actually, phytoremediating that soil is going to be huge. But I want to thank you guys so much for watching. Thank you for everyone who reached out asking what the heck to do, because you've encountered the same thing. If you're a new gardener, please do the test. Do the litmus test. I've discussed this on several videos before. Do the test. It'll save you time and money and frustration, to say the least. And if you have cupping, spindly leaves, anything like that, this is a sign that you're potentially having this issue. Anyways, I want to thank you guys for watching, and I will talk to you guys next time. Bye.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Check out our great selection of garage and utility lighting options. In stock, ready to take home today. We carry everything to help you illuminate whatever project you're working on. Shop garage and utility lighting products in store at your nearest Menards. You can also view all of our entire selection of lighting options today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.